Now we're recording. Now we're ready to go. And now the wave looks normal. Welcome to the podcast, Osama. This is a big day for me personally. As I said to you, I've already made this joke to you before, but I have to do it again because I have now completed the full set of MacDeezy Brothers. This is the third one, and I'm very proud of myself. This is a long-held accomplishment. Now I have to move on to your parents' generation of MacDeezy, so I can have the baseball card collection. Like, I've had all the brothers. Now I'm going to work my way up to the parents. So thank you for coming on the show and fulfilling a long-held dream that I've had.
It's a great pleasure, Asina, for me to be here and for me to help you complete your set. But I wish the circumstances were happier, but it is what it is. And so I'm really pleased to be here with you.
Yeah, this is the circumstances are interesting, given the topic of your book and given the sort of this project of yours. That's not just this book, but a running theme in your intellectual sort of career has been this question of sectarianism, identity. We're here today to talk about Age of Coexistence, the Ecumenical Frame, and the Making of the Modern Arab World from University of California Press, 2019. You know, I thought from the beginning, I instead of sort of jumping into the argument of the book, maybe I was thinking we can begin by thinking around like the problem of thinking through sectarianism and how that relates to, you know, the historical, let's say, reality or present or whatever of living in the aftermath of the Ottoman Empire. Because as I said to you in our pre-interview is that, you know, I have kind of the Ottoman Empire is a big blind spot for this podcast for me. It's something that kind of exists on this strange horizon. Turkey in general, kind of, I've avoided, even though I spent, you know, years of my childhood in Turkey, incidentally. It was like a first language I spoke. So I'm kind of embarrassed to kind of tackle these things. So I learned a lot from your book. And I don't know, I feel like since I haven't done a good job, but maybe you can kind of explain to us the basics of, you know, the reality of living in the post-Ottoman world, because you are a child of it, really, like being grown up in Lebanon or U.S., between Lebanon and the U.S. Maybe we can kind of begin with that and then lead to the argument of the book, which kind of responds to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that all of us, anyone who lives in the Mashriq or in the Arab East, or in fact, in what is today the modern Middle East, essentially is living in the shadow in the aftermath of the Ottoman Empire. That goes without saying, since the Ottomans ruled the Arab East for 400 years. And so the impact was enormous. And what I'd like to say at the beginning, I mean, the Ottomans, obviously, I mean, it depends which period of the Ottoman Empire we're talking about. But I think it's really important to emphasize two things, Sina. One is, it's sort of a slip that you made in your introduction. People often conflate Ottoman history with Turkish history. And so, you know, it's Ottoman history, you know, includes the Arab world, includes the Arab past as well. And the Arabs were part of the Ottoman Empire. And that's one thing that I really want to insist. On the other hand, the empire, of course, was a project of power, like all imperial formations. And I don't want to romanticize this empire, but it was, in essence, a until the 19th century, and in fact, through the 19th century, a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-linguistic empire, polity. And the Arabs had a place, a subordinate place in this empire, but there was no citizenship and there was no equality, certainly, until the 19th century. And sort of what I try to do, and I think what people, your listeners, may need to sort of grapple with, is that this empire wasn't doomed to decline in the way the stereotypical understanding of Ottoman history puts it. It's not like the empire was on this sort of long trajectory of catastrophic decline. The empire was destroyed in a particular period, and there were many factors that went into that destruction. And in the chaos, and not just the chaos, but also in the chaos is the wrong word, but in the aftermath of the destruction of the empire, European powers, as you know, Britain and France, basically divided up this region, the Mashriq, the Arab East, the modern Arab world, and into deliberately, cynically, along sectarian lines, and above all, along colonial lines, to suit their interests and not the interests of the people of this region. And we've been living in the aftermath of those fateful decisions after the First World War ever since. Pretty much every single major conflict in the Arab East can be traced directly to those fateful decisions after the First World War.
Right. So this is the, so we are far from what you call the ecumenical frame, right? Like we are far from that historically speaking, because we now live in the sort of post, I mean, the closest sort of thing historically to us is the sort of post Sykes-Picot world. I guess if we want to sort of historicize it in that way or periodize it, we live in the sort of great acts of partition, kind of, what's the term from the first chapter? I always quote on this episode, God, I forget it. From the introduction to Orientalism, Said calls it imaginative geography.
Imaginative, right?
And so, yeah, so like this, we live in the consequences of those literal pencils and pens drawn by bureaucrats, you know, a century ago. And we really are living that out today as Zionist troops walk into Al-Aqsa. You know, like it's quite like stark to think about like how history lives with us. It's not dead. It's not something that's, you know, nice and cloistered into museums, that like the real world decision made by like flesh and blood people, you know, like affect other human beings to this day and have drastically affected the lives of hundreds of millions, if not billions of people from just our region alone. And that's not even to include the other global empires that existed alongside the French and the British, right? Like the Germans were also in the Mashriq for a while. They tried. But, you know, like that kind of the history making and the sort of, I feel like, you know, we were forged on the crucible of empire. And I get, this is just as much true for an Iranian as it is, I think, for a Lebanese, Palestinian, anyone. I mean, it's different. There's different history of conquest and colonization. But all of this is to say is that, like, was coexistence before, like the idea of coexistence, or at least the life under the Ottoman Empire, does that for you, does that constitute a kind of ecumenical life?
Yes, absolutely. First of all, in the sense that, I mean, the first thing to say to that is coexistence has to be historicized. In other words, put in context and specified. There's no such thing as coexistence that's eternal, that is outside of politics, that is outside of power. I think that really is essential, because a lot of people use the term coexistence as a cognate for equality. So we talk about coexistence as if not just as a bumper sticker, but also as something good and obvious. But its coexistence depends on the political, material, economic, social, cultural, religious, ideological conditions in which coexistence is taking place. And so there's no question that there obviously was coexistence in the Ottoman Empire. But it varied from century to century, from town to town, from decade to decade, from moment to moment. But if we have to generalize, there is no question that within the Islamic Ottoman Empire, and of course within prior Islamic empires, there was a space that was opened up for non-Muslims, and specifically Christians and Jews. This is the well-known, I mean, there's nothing here I'm saying is especially controversial. There was a space opened up for non-Muslims to practice their religion, sort of religious and cultural autonomy, which the Ottomans, in a sense, sort of, we historians say that the Ottomans sort of formalized it in the millet system, in this idea of having these different communities regulate their own religious affairs and cultural affairs. And the Ottoman state didn't try to make everybody an Ottoman, didn't try to enforce any kind of homogeneity in their empire. So there certainly was what we would say today is pluralism, coexistence, but there was no equality and there was no citizenship. But on the other hand, nor was there systematic persecution of Christians and Jews in this empire. I think a lot of people who, especially those of us who come from, let's just say, quote unquote, minority backgrounds, often, you know, are sort of fed this line that the Ottomans were a persecutory society, that Christians were persecuted in the Ottoman Empire. And there were moments of persecution, of course, but it wasn't just directed at Christians or Armenians or at other groups all the time. The persecution happened in particular moments, and they were directed at any group that challenged the power of the Ottoman state. But within the state, there is unquestionably a culture of coexistence that existed even without, in a sense, state direction. I mean, people have lived together, Muslims and Christians and Jews have lived together in the Arab East for centuries, long before the Ottomans even arrived in 1516, 1517. And they continued to coexist after the Ottomans left in 1918. So I think we have to specify what we mean by coexistence. So there is, I don't think, and to answer your other question about Sykes-Picot, I don't think the European partition of our world, as damaging as that partition was, and as cynical as it was, and the point always is to underscore, it's not just bureaucrats who did it, it's colonial bureaucrats and officials who did it, to serve the interests of Britain and France, first and foremost. This did enormous damage in our part of the world. It divided up a geography. It created, as you said, these lines that have taken on a reality, a durable reality, and a terrible reality of their own. It created all these. It created the state of Lebanon as we know it, the sectarian state as we know it today. It created. It allowed colonial Zionism to be privileged in Palestine. It divided Syria, as you know, into various bits and pieces. And so this kind of division, you know, was on the one hand extremely cynical and negative, but on the other hand, Seema, it didn't end coexistence, or what I call the ecumenical sort of form of coexistence. In other words, the idea that Muslims, Christians, and Jews in the Ottoman period could transcend without abandoning their particularities, their faith. They could transcend that faith without negating it, and join in commonality as Ottomans. So in the post-Ottoman period, you see the same thing happening with the earliest formations of Arab or Syrian or Palestinian identities. People, or Egypt, which wasn't colonized by the French, but was occupied by the British in 1882. The same idea, that people could transcend their sectarian or their communal differences into a sense of commonality. And when the British and the French partitioned our part of the world, this actually energized. It was negative on one level in terms of the cynicism and the colonial division, but it also provided a focal point for people to rally against. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, that people could say, no, we're not just Muslims and Christians. We're not just majority and minority. We're Syrians, we're Egyptians, we're Arabs, and so on. We're Palestinians, and so on and so forth.
Right. And that's actually something that it's shared with, at least I think, the history of indigenous people in what's now called North America, is that you have a forging, and really the Western Hemisphere in general, is that you do have a forging of an identity of indigeneity against the backdrop of the settler. And it's this, you know, I mean, obviously it's this kind of dialectical process that continues to sort of, you know, fuck up our shit, in the sense that, like, it forces you to accept the historical violence of empires as the starting point of your thinking, in a way, right? Because, you know, there is the Arab nationalist argument that this is all just one Bilad Hashem, right? I mean, I'm not saying I'm not erasing Palestinians in general, but there is a certain kind of vision of Arab nationalism as we should just have all one big country, right? We're Arabs, our Arabness links it together. Now, I understand that obviously failed miserably, and like, you know, what are the UAR? It lasted 2 years, not even, United Arab Republic. So like, and that was like two countries barely. So, you know, that's not what I'm sort of asking for, or sort of promulgating, but in the sense that like, there is a kind of discursive trap of forcing yourself to identify as a Palestinian, as a Lebanese, as a Syrian national in a post-imperial world. Now, is there any other way around that? Probably not. I mean, I guess there is. I guess in some ways there is Islamic identities, Muslim identities, religious sectarian identities, as you say. But there is as a kind of antidote, right? And that's another thing that I wanted to mention about when you're talking about coexistence, is that this idea of coexistence, and liberalism goes with this, they go hand in hand, is that the fiction of liberalism is that it brought enlightenment to the dark places of the earth. Right, is that before that time they lacked these ideas about that liberalism is supposedly associated with. Now, being critical subjects, educated people, we know that this is bullshit. That liberalism brought with it genocide and destruction and racism, and like I can see through liberalism's lie. However, I think in some ways, and I think your book is good for like sort of really good for teaching us this, is that deprogramming ourselves with this idea that before the arrival of sort of Euro or of Euro enlightenment, is that there were other formations of identity that weren't just what Enlightenment thinkers and European thinkers projected onto us, which is, oh, these are the Shiites of this country, these are the Sunni of this country, this is the blank, these are the Kurds. And the way that, and I can't help but wonder, is it like, do they project their own incredibly long history of violence and sectarianism onto us as a kind of coping mechanism, because they can't imagine any other kind of world, because, you know, we had our War of the Roses, they have to have their own, right? Like, and I can't help but feel that sometimes that, I wonder if you see this as a historian, is that the sort of hermeneutical liberalism of the academy is then transposed onto the Mashreq, the West Asia, and creates this idea of, oh, they just need to be, what will solve their problems is, you know, ethnostates or religious, you know, religiously organized, you know, identity formations, which can be set against other different ones. So it's like, you know, this is a persistent mess. And I wonder if there's like a philosophical issue here.
Well, I mean, there's two points to that. I mean, yeah, of course, there is the idea that when European and then, of course, today American imperial officials come into the Middle East and dominate the Middle East and divide the Middle East and want to sort of project their hegemony and justify their hegemony, part of it, as I said, is cynical. Part of it, you could say, is, as you're saying, projecting their own history onto us, onto our part of the world. That's one thing. I'll address that in a moment. But I think it's also, as you said earlier, it's crucial to understand that in the case of the Arab world, of the Ottoman history, of Islamic history, there's a huge, vast, literate culture, records, archives that exist that long predate European interventions. And this is, I think, in the sense when you say the academy, you mean, I assume, the Western academy. But their whole point is that there is a huge archive that exists that we have barely, I think, honestly, barely begun to untap. But it's recognized. There's a huge Islamic tradition, an Arab tradition. There's an Ottoman tradition. There's a whole sort of way of thinking about one's identity and one's place in these worlds that is well established long before the Europeans arrived. And so this is, in terms of the sort of pedagogy and in terms of the hermeneutics, as you're talking about, in terms of understanding and studying the Arab world, the modern Arab world and Ottoman history, what makes it different from other colonial experiences is that we have a robust, massive, obvious archive that exists all the way until the end of the empire after the First World War. And so it's our history does not in any way, it does not begin, obviously, no history begins with the colonialists, but almost a lot of colonial history begins with the damage and the violence of the colonial sort of arrival. And then you try to recuperate what came before. In our case, the history is obvious, and in Iran as well, obviously, the history is obvious and massive and recorded. So we have to sort of grapple with that history on its own terms. And then try to sort of relate that history on its own terms, on its own dynamic, complex terms, coexistence without equality. And what does that mean? And the variability of that coexistence. And the fact that we've barely studied this coexistence, honestly. And then how do we relate it to what happens after the extraordinarily consequential arrival of European imperialism in its sort of most aggressive fashion, which is after World War I, when they divide up this region and create new states, in whose legacies, in whose sort of under whose authority many of us suffer. So I think we need to distinguish. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, our history there's a pre-colonial history, like a pre-colonial history that has power in and of itself, that we, like the Ottomans, were not simply innocent natives. I mean, the Ottomans were also a formation of power. And it's one of the problems in the history, in historiography, is that, you know, you're caught in this thing where you're always reacting to European colonialism and European imperialism and Western imperialism, that we don't pay enough attention to theorizing Ottoman power, for example. Do you see what I'm saying? And you actually need to do that without distracting from the fact that there is European power too, and there are imperial projects. And it's not about saying one does not exist because the other exists.
I mean, it's well known that the British and the French supported Arab uprisings against the Ottomans, right? I mean, this is how we got... This is how you get T.E. Lawrence as a kind of brand name.
Oh, absolutely.
That this idea of, you know, essentially, I mean, we wouldn't call it back then, but it was a kind of regime change project that to this day, you know, I don't think, I mean, maybe I haven't checked in on the hagiography or the biography of T.E. Lawrence, but, you know, I mean, he was one of the most famous early regime changers in the sense that to be such a powerful image of like what actual literal Orientalism is, which is a turn of creating knowledge as a weapon to accelerate and amplify your political sort of imperial machinations. Now, is it only that? No, but a huge sort of part of the sort of historical baggage we need to deal with is the fact that, yeah, like there has been a history of foreign powers supporting Arab revolts to overturn the whatever sort of prevailing order that is, right? And
yes.
That's not, yeah. And that's part of it too, is that the violence of identity is not just in the initial creation of those quote unquote fake countries. I mean, all countries are fake. We should get that clear. All countries are fake. Some are more fake than others. But the creation of countries like Lebanon, Syria, right? The division of these lands, we don't just live in the hangover of that, but also, I guess in some ways,
overlaid by other histories, by other histories of despotism.
Exactly. Yeah. And like that is something that haunts. I mean, to use the haunt is kind of cheap now because it's kind of like it's silly now to talk in these kind of spectral terms. But really, like it's really. I mean, I guess in some ways you do this because there is a kind of logic in thinking about the Ottoman Empire as this ecumenical frame, but also preceding that to kind of rescue that, because in some ways the Ottoman Empire didn't do what we think of empires, at least in the European sense. They weren't white supremacist empires, right? They weren't like that's the kind of predominant framework of Western liberal empire, French, German, English, obviously Spanish, that whiteness tied those projects together in a way that I guess Islam tied Ottoman Empire, but Islam was different, right? Islam is not a race. I mean, let me put it this way. This is a big jumble of a question, but it's leading to this, is that Islam as a category of identity making, right, is something that was produced by the Ottoman Empire, if I'm not wrong, right? Like that kind of like Islam in some ways, I kind of say this, like Islam doesn't exist in some real ways. Like Islam is a name that we give to a very large and very complicated, very diverse tradition tied to, you know, obviously the Quran and Muhammad and, you know, like important figures, but articulated in all these different kinds of ways. So like when we say the word Islam as a noun, right, are we doing like a disservice? Are we creating a kind of fictional entity that, you know, can be used for whatever purposes? I guess that's where my end quote question was going, which is a bunch of questions wrapped up into one. So sorry, yeah, I tend to do that.
No worries. I mean, I would say, obviously, I mean, Islam is not simply produced by the Ottoman state. I mean, there are Muslims throughout the Ottoman Empire, and of course, outside of the Ottoman Empire, who are producing Islam in many different ways. And of course, even within the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman state, of course, and the Ottoman imperial sort of state, did create the office of the Sheikh al-Islam, like the highest sort of, in a sense, religious figure, in a sense, to co-opt Islam and to make sure that there was a sense of control over this extraordinarily diverse, as you say, and rich and extraordinary tradition, and to co-opt it and to service it to make it serve the interests of the imperial sultanate. There's no question of that. But that's not, of course, all of Islam, and it never was. And the whole point is that the Ottomans faced constant rebellions. They faced constant criticism, constant alternative interpretations of Islam. So there's no single interpretation of Islam in that sense. So to answer that question, in terms of the Sykes, Lawrence, I mean the tragedy of what you're talking about there, Sina, we're jumping around here a little bit, but since you began with Lawrence and you ended with Islam, let me go back to what I see as the central the point, and the point that does actually affect the way we do research on this pivotal moment right after the First World War. Lawrence was an imperial agent. Lawrence was an Orientalist. Lawrence was, by any standard, an outrageous figure, and his myth and his celebrity is in the West, primarily, not in the Arab world. But the tragedy of Lawrence is of course the power differential. So you had Faisal, and you had who was the son of Sharif Hussein, who's in Paris, basically begging the British, and then the Americans, and then the French, begging them for crumbs. For a state, in essence, on behalf of his father. The Syrians were not allowed to represent themselves. The Palestinians were not allowed to represent themselves. The Egyptians were not allowed to represent themselves. the only people who were allowed to represent themselves were the Zionists on the one hand, and of course you had Faisal, who was there as the representative of his father, Sharif Hussein, in Mecca. And he was there pleading, but we have very few, I mean, so the records we have of those encounters are largely written either by Lawrence himself, or, and in terms of the richness of the records, in other words, the quantity and the copiousness of the records, by Lawrence or by people around Lawrence. So we have very little sense of what Faisal actually thought in those moments, other than what we can extrapolate from British and a few memoirs of people who were associated with Faisal, and of course Lawrence himself. But Lawrence played an extremely devious role. I mean, Lawrence was completely committed to the British Empire. He was committed to Zionism. He was committed to the whole idea of, let's create this Arab kingdom and let's reconcile this Arab kingdom, dependent of course on Britain. Let's reconcile this Arab kingdom in Arabia and possibly in Syria, but not in Palestine, and not in any way that contravenes British imperial interests in Iraq and other places in the Gulf. So he was an extremely pernicious figure whose role has been massively exaggerated by the historiography in terms of his empathy with the Arabs. It's a completely orientalist, racist relationship to the Arabs. So the tragedy is that Faisal was weak, and so we get to the situation of trying to judge and make sense of Faisal. Is, do you judge him for being a collaborator? In other words, somebody who basically, you know, pleaded with the more powerful and recognized the power differential, or do you recognize him as who pleaded with the powerful, but and played their game in a sense, trying to get whatever he could from that game for himself and for his family? Or do you see him as a total a tragic figure, or do you see him as a sellout, or how do we make sense of Faisal given the fact that the records are overwhelmingly British in this instance?
I mean, there is another guy at the Paris Peace Conference. He was a cook, and that was Ho Chi Minh. And he asked them for some time to speak, and they denied it to him. So I feel like there's two modes of indigenous resistance, right? Like two empires, like two modes of anti-colonial resistance. You can either want a seat at the table and get it, at least participate in the fiction of the seat at that table and be rewarded, you know. And how did Faisal live the rest of his days? Like, think about how that worked out for him and also his family too. I mean, I guess they got Jordan, right? But
no, he went back to Syria. Then he became king of Iraq.
The British made him king of Iraq.
Yeah,
the leftover of that is Jordan, right? The Hashemite kingdom, isn't it? Am I wrong?
His brother Abdullah was given the Emirate of Jordan,
right?
Which was created by the British, yeah.
And then he was later assassinated, right? King Faisal was later assassinated.
Abdullah was assassinated in Jordan.
Faisal died
in Iraq.
Right. Well, so actually, like this is, so I mean, I feel that like there are these two modes of do you work with the imperialists or do you fight them? And obviously for the Vietnamese, it took many, many more decades and God knows a huge chunk of their population and incredible scars, but they're an independent country now. They don't have to worry about ever being occupied again. I mean, I guess maybe, who knows the future, but
well, who knows?
At least,
yeah.
Yeah. And like, but in the sense that like that sovereignty was hard won, has that really like in comparing that, is it a fair comparison? I don't know, maybe not, but like, because it's different kinds of empires. But
yeah, but you could say that, Sina. You could say that, and you could. I mean, I think that comparison is in a sense unfair. In the sense that I think what I would do is I would say that what the point in common is that Ho Chi Minh, Du Bois, Palestinian nationalists, Egyptian nationalists, Syrian nationalists were all ignored. And of course, Korean nationalists, Indian nationalists, all sorts of nationalists who went to Paris were utterly disappointed by the sort of, as you said, the sort of the racial hierarchy, the white supremacists, I mean, the imperialists, the colonial sort of insistence on remaking the world after World War I as a continuation of empire rather than as a diminution of empire. So they were all disappointed by that because they were all ignored. And I think that's what I would look at rather than say, was Ho Chi Minh better than Faisal? Obviously, Ho Chi Minh is I think, a different caliber than Faisal, but the conditions are also different. The Vietnamese were also under colonialism for a long period. And let's not forget that Syrians and Palestinians and Iraqis and Egyptians all fought against colonialism in that moment, and they were all crushed by colonialism. So there's a certain point where, you know, resistance is always taking place, but there are different forms of resistance. The question that Faisal asks, is to say, okay, it's one thing to resist colonialism and militarily, but when you are going to be overwhelmed, this is his rationale. I'm not defending, because I think honestly he was a pathetic figure, a tragic figure almost, you could say. But in his sort of, in the way that he and his father sort of dealt with the British, there is a kind of, a tragic element, but also a pathetic element to them. Their argument, though, to us is to say, well, you know, you can resist all you want, but in the end of the day, these people are the ones with the overwhelming power, and you do, whether you like it or not, have to adjust yourselves to the overwhelming fact of power. That's what they say. That's how they rationalize their collaboration with the British and the French at the time.
I mean, and it's also something that you hear from some of, at least, the people who support the war on the Syrian state. I mean, that's a different also beast altogether, but that's something that has been a through line, and the overlap, like, you can't, I mean, I don't know, is it a fair thing to compare British support of Faisal to American CIA MI6 support of Syrian rebels? I don't know. Is it? Maybe not. Maybe the situation is different. Okay. But like the reality is that what we call, like, a lot of the Arab revolutions that are maybe not just celebrated, but sort of forged into the sort of history of the region, some of them are different than others, right? Like the revolution in Egypt, for instance, like, is different than, say, I don't know, the revolution in Libya, is different than, say, like, the rejection, the overthrow, like, the rise of the Ba'ath Party, right? Like, part of the problem that someone I think like you works with is that we're talking about a massive range of countries with hundreds of millions of people, and so it's impossible to kind of make any kind of grand statements without sort of stepping in contradictions and whatever, right? So I get that, you know, these questions are kind of impossible for you to answer,
But I don't mind that. I mean, I don't mind. I mean, the whole point is that being a historian and being a scholar, the whole point of this is to actually accept contradiction and nuance, and to say, okay, right. I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. Otherwise, there's no value added in my having this conversation. If all I'm going to say is that it's always been the same and it's always going to be the same, then there's no point actually doing the kind of studies that I do, or that, you know, that I think good historians do, which is to try to bring alive the past in a way that's meaningful for the present, but also with contradictions, because the whole point of where we are and where we've been is that there is no simple, it's not like the Ottomans were a third world anti-colonial nation. I mean, I think that's important to understand. I mean, you said that they weren't supremacists, but the CUP, by the end of the empire, the CUP was extraordinarily nationalist, and it did racialize the empire in a certain way, and it did carry out the genocide against the Armenians, and there was deportation of Greeks, and, you know, and there was sort of oppression of all sorts of groups and communities, you know, in the empire. So it's not like, by the end, it was a very bitter experience, but also in the context, of course, of massive European intervention, in the context of the ethno-religious nationalist wars of the Balkans, in the context of the deportation of Muslims from the Balkans and from the Caucasus, from the whole long history of that throughout the 19th century. So things are complicated, and but my point is, rather than saying things are complicated and leaving it at that, which is what apologists do, is to delve into those things and not say, oh, things are complicated, therefore we can't talk about it or take an ethical position on something. But we do need to accept that contradiction is, and tensions and ambiguities are part of our history, even if there are some things that are absolutely crystal clear, such as European colonialism, such as the fact that Sykes-Picot, in other words, the will to divide up this region was done not for the interests of the people of the region, but for the interests of imperial power. I think that is so, and people often say, well, you know, Lebanon is an artificial state. You know, I don't buy any of that stuff, in the sense that Lebanon is an artificial state. So too is Syria. So too is Palestine. So too is Canada. So too is the United States. Every country is artificial. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't mean very much to me to say they're artificial. Yeah. The question is really, what are the conditions in which certain sort of political communities are forged? Who is excluded? Who is included? Why?
Right. And And I do, yeah, that's, and that's something that is something, there's an interesting thing page in the introduction. You say that there was that, going back to the question of the Ottomans, because I think what I was mentioning earlier is that there wasn't necessarily a white supremacist empire. It wasn't settler colonial in the same way. Yes, prejudices and racism exist, I'm sure, obviously, ask the Armenians, ask lots of different populations under them. I imagine they would have their own very, very powerful, very, very passionate opinions about that. But like, it's more the fact that like the model of imperialism that we know, that like all of us are part of, in a sense, living on North American indigenous land, is a white settler colonial empire that was descended from Europe. Now, here's the question I have. Is Zionism a European settler colonial movement, or did it take elements of Ottoman history, of Ottoman conquest? Did it inherit those things and, you know, like something and mixed with it? Is it an adulteration of different empires added, obviously, with its own unique flavor of, you know, of creating a separate or sort of Jew or Jewish state? Like, what is the relationship there?
Well, I mean, as I try to explain in the book, I mean, the Zionism clearly, in terms of 19th century Zionism, emerges in Europe. I mean, there's no doubt about that. This is fact. This is history. This is indisputable. And it emerges in response to and reaction to, in dialectic, if you want to use that term, with various currents of European nationalism, European romanticism, anti-Semitism, and of course, colonialism. I mean, and so when they...
It's one answer to the Jewish question, so to speak. Like, that's one answer.
Well, the Jewish question in quotation marks, which of course is a European question.
Exactly. I mean,
again,
yeah.
And it's really important to emphasize this. And so to say, again, in the when we step back and look at Ottoman history, there was no Jewish question in that same way. Obviously, I mean, there was, and in the 19th century, part of what my book shows is that, of course, the question that emerges in the 19th century is the Eastern question, which involved overwhelmingly European intervention on behalf of Christian communities. And it's the Armenians who become sort of, by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, they become the focal point of the Eastern question. And in 1860, the massacre that I talk about in Damascus in July of 1860, that's sort of one of the pivots of the book, the Jewish community was not attacked. The point is that there was a Jewish question in Europe, and Zionism is in response, in dialectic with that, but also in the context of European nationalism, European anti-Semitism, and above all, European colonialism. Because when Theodore Herzl and other Zionists imagine where they're going to place this Jewish state, where is this Jewish state going to be? It's not going to be in Europe. It's going to be in what we today call the global south of the third world. They place it in Palestine. They had thought Argentina for a while. They had thought Uganda possibly. But in the end, they choose Palestine. And not simply because of an obvious historic Jewish connection to Palestine at the level of religion, at the level of all this spirituality, but also, of course, because the Zionists understood, the European Zionists understood, that they needed British support to enable and to get this project going. So my point is that it's responding to European currents, and then it gets pushed, or it gets coercively through the Balfour Declaration, after the Balfour Declaration, and especially with the British mandate in Palestine, it gets placed in Palestine despite and against the manifest wishes of the indigenous native population, the overwhelmingly Arab population of Palestine. And I think, it's a transportation of an ethno-religious nationalist model from Europe that gets put, responding to European problems. That gets, and that of course is what we see playing out until today. I think that's one part of my book. And the other part of the book is to say, and that in a sense for, I think, scholars on the left, I think that's almost the easier part of the argument. Although most people, I don't think, know this history very well. The other part is to sort of relate it to other histories in our region without, again, the important point, Sina, is not to dilute from the oppression of the Palestinians in any way, shape, or form, but to actually put this all in context and to take the question of Palestine and to say, let's think of it in relationship to other questions that emerge: Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, the Ottoman case, the Armenians, and so on and so forth, and see how that works in relation. So let's not start the story with Herzl always and then have Palestine simply as the place where everything happens. How does it what happens if we think of it as a history of Zionism that's emerging in response to European questions that gets put into a place that already has a rich, dynamic, evolving, important history of coexistence that was itself changing. That's one of the points of the book, that in other words, Muslim and non-Muslim coexistence as equality, as citizenship, with all the problems of the 19th century, was elaborated, it seems to me, in my reading, was elaborated most powerfully and most obviously in the Mashriq. And yet that's the one place of the world where the Europeans come in and divide everything along sectarian lines and introduce a new conflict between what the Europeans and the Zionists thought of as, quote, Jews versus Arabs. And we're still living with the consequences of all these divisions.
Right. And this is something that I've noticed with like a certain class of journalist, researcher, academic, usually like always not from our region, and how they adopt certain ethnicities or religions or identities as like their passion project. So there are like self-identified sort of like Kurd guys, like Germans, or, you know, and they just like run around and they like, it really is that thing. The East is a career in terms of transforming and transfixing your own life, your professional life, the one that makes you money, onto the complicated, heartbreaking, tragic, violent, terrible histories and region and like complications of somebody else's world. And so to me, like, that's been one of the lasting legacies of the incredible ideological force of the media, for instance, of like the Western media, and with the complicity of all kinds of academics and radical ones, and not just white people, right? Like lots of Arabs supported the violent uprisings in Syria, for instance, under the banner of, oh, there is a sectarian rule that is represented by the al-Assad family, which is this minority rule. But these people often never say anything about a country like Bahrain, right? Where the same thing is happening, but in reverse, where you have a majority Shia population ruled over by a tiny, wealthy, extremely authoritarian Sunni elite, right? And like, which have connections to foreign powers who help ensure that their power base is still strong, right? So like, that to me is something that I always found very troubling, in that certain kinds of critique are conveniently leveled on countries that are enemies of the West and then excused from others, right? I mean, I do have one sort of follow-up.
Can I just jump in there, Sina, on that point? I think it's important, though, to actually, again, rather than say, so when you're talking about Syria versus Bahrain and the way the mobilization here for Syria as opposed to for Bahrain, rather than say, well, what about Bahrain? I think it's more important for us to say, look, there has been incredible cruelty and despotism in Syria, and there is a struggle for liberation in Syria. That's been co-opted and hijacked, whatever you want to say, fine, but there has been a struggle for liberation in Syria from the oppression of an extraordinarily repressive regime, the Assad regime. And you also have a struggle in Bahrain, and you also have a struggle in Palestine, and you also have a struggle in Libya. You've had a struggle all over this region, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and so on and so forth. I mean, you've had all sorts of struggles. And for me, it's always important to emphasize the fact that the empathy should be with the people who are fighting against despotism and for liberation, not with the fact that, the point that you're raising about how in the West, for example, there's a sort of a minority du jour kind of thing, you know, where they fixate, they discover a certain oppressed group, always conveniently in the West. It's always convenient that this started with the Armenians in the 19th century, when American missionaries and others sort of, you know, took up the cause of the Armenians.
Mr. Woodrow Wilson was Mr. Kurd. Well, he was big friend of the Kurds, supposedly, until he wasn't.
of the Armenians, you mean?
But I also thought the Kurdish question was part of the 14 points, right? Wasn't it? I'm pretty sure. Maybe not. I'm wrong.
Not the Kurdish question. But Woodrow Wilson and the Americans were certainly sort of interested in the Armenian, in the fate of the Armenians. But there was oppression of the Armenians. There's no doubt about that. How it gets instrumentalized, how it gets manipulated, in the West. Why the selective sort of, you know? So we could fixate on how it is that here, the emphasis is always on, for example, the Christian or the minority victim, rather than, for example, on the masses of people who get oppressed in the region, most of whom are Muslim, who get oppressed. And so we don't tend to look. And of course, the way sort of. There's all these contradictions you could look at, and I think it's important to point these out, but it's also important to insist that just because American missionaries manipulate and then later on other groups manipulate the idea of sympathy and translate sympathy in Orientalist, racist, and ultimately imperialist terms, doesn't mean that we as scholars should shut our eyes to the reality of the Armenians or the Kurds or the Arabs or any group that suffers in these contexts. And so I think it's important I think that's the hardest part about being history, is how do you narrate the actual history, you know, empathetically, and at the same time be aware of how it's being instrumentalized outside. What's interesting about the Armenian case, and all these cases, in fact, is how there was an obsession with the Armenians, with the question of the Armenians, until the Kemalists came along and destroyed the whole idea after when the Republic of Turkey is created. And then it's amazing how the whole Armenian question sort of in a sense is is frozen, essentially. So the people here lose interest, and then they move on to some other cause they're always moving on to one cause, but it's always a cause of somebody else far away, typically, when it comes to our part of the world. So it's, do you see what I'm saying? So
absolutely. I think I do want to say that, like, to go back to the previous question, though, is that, and this is what I wanted to sort of follow up with, is that there are versions of sectarianism that don't necessarily result in racist apartheid support, like, you know, colonial violence, right? Like, they're like, you were writing this book during the rise of ISIS, correct, right? During its worst days, right? Correct. That is obviously an easy thing to categorize. It's easy to sort of diagnose it. It is this fascist disease that needs to be stamped out very, very violently, because that's the only way. Like, there's no negotiation with ISIS. Like, there's no talking with ISIS. And the people that we in the West tend to see as victims of the Assad regime, many of them joined the SSA to fight for their country against ISIS. And the same thing with the Hashid, right? The Hashid was literally created by a Shia cleric who said that our people are being genocided in different villages and towns across our region. 60% of Iraq was under ISIS control. And it just, you know what I mean? Like, that is a emergency that I don't think that, like, we could even fathom in being where we live, right? I mean, ask the indigenous people, they could probably fathom it for sure. But, like, so the fact that the Hashid proved so effective in turning the tide against ISIS tells me that at least part of the sectarian problem, it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. Hezbollah is another example, right? Hezbollah is a sectarian movement, is it not? But it is respected, at least large chunks of Lebanon respect their fight against the occupation, which they successfully defeated. So I do want to push back, and I feel like I should push back, in the sense that, like, there is a formula for, you know, can we just, I don't know, like, what, how do you sort of theorize the Hashid?
Well, first of all, I would say, just to step back a bit about the bigger question, it's related to the book more. You have to make a distinction between what you say when you say sectarian, which is a negative term, which is a term of opprobrium, and when you say religion or faith or communal or community. So there's a difference. In other words, people have complex identities, and there's no question that in our part of the world, communalist identities have been sort of encouraged, have been structured, have been legitimated, are part of state formations, and therefore, not surprisingly, and of course, are related to the fact that that the Middle East is, and obviously both Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, the entire region is an extraordinarily rich, in terms of religiously rich, area, historically speaking. So there's no surprise that people, that religion or religious communities or sectarian, or you're calling sectarian, as in communal identities, are important. But the point I try to make in the book, and the point, again, to answer your question, is that there's no such thing as a single communal identity or sectarian identity that is unchanging over time. A sectarian identity or a communal or religious identity can be mobilized in a form of liberation, and it can also be mobilized in the most extraordinary, depraved manner. And the question is to historicize and contextualize so that we don't end up in this scenario where we're saying that religion, you know, this is a religious part of the world as opposed to a rich part of the world. Because I don't think it's any more religious or any less religious than other parts of the world. I just think that it's got its own distinct history, and we need to be more precise when we talk about the elements that go into identity formation and the dynamism of that. So in other words, like not all religious identifications are negative. Not all are invented, of course, by the colonial powers. That goes without saying. That's what I alluded to earlier when I said that there's a long, rich history, long before the colonialists ever dreamed of partitioning the Ottoman Empire. There is a history. I mean, there is stratification that takes place. People have their own ways of thinking and imagining and reading the world. That's not just simply imbibing what the Europeans tell them. But the question is, how do you relate that to what happens afterwards? How do you relate that not just to what happens afterwards with the European colonialists who come in as foreigners, as Orientalists, as imperialists, with one intent, which is to divide this region up, to extract resources, and to sort of, or to keep the people pacified? And then how do you deal with the reaction to that, the so-called post-colonial, which then brings us to the Assad regime and the other regimes? And then, of course, then you have the U.S. invasion in 2003 and the catastrophes that it's sort of unleashed.
Yeah, I mean, which is, you know, and I always like to say that, like, you think identity politics is just like a thing that minority identities sort of adopt. It's like, no, white supremacy is identity politics. It's one of the most oldest and advanced forms of identity politics, linking together the destruction of vast chunks of South America, the slavery in places like Brazil, the triangular trade, right? Like, whiteness links all those projects together. And just to go back to our first question, which was the Ottoman, and I don't know, is there a corollary to whiteness? Is it Ottomanness? I mean, Ottoman did exist, right? There was an Ottoman language, but it was a tongue for scholars, right? It wasn't like something that people conversed in, was it? No, it was like a colonial.
Sorry. No, I wouldn't call it a colonial. I mean, there's Ottoman Turkish, of course, and which by the 19th century, you know, there's Ottoman Turkish as a language that borrows a lot from Arabic and borrows a lot from Farsi, obviously. So there's a lot of there's Ottoman Turkish, there's Arabic, of course, there's all these other languages that exist in the empire. It depends on which locale in the empire we're talking about. The point about the empire is that it didn't try until the very end of the empire, when it did try under the CUP. Before that moment, it didn't try to homogenize the entirety of the population. It did. There was no need to do this, which is why we think of it as a form, as an extraordinary sort of moment of coexistence. But of course, there was power, and what I completely do not accept is this sort of myth of the Ottomans as somehow tolerant, which is sort of, again, a romantic reading of a way of structuring difference, religious difference, to serve Ottoman power. That's not necessarily, you know, peaceful. I mean, if you're outside, you were smashed, basically. If the Ottomans, you know, wanted to go after you, they did, and they did all sorts of brutal, horrible things. So it's not, the point is to, again, historicize and contextualize without falling into myths as much as possible.
I mean, that's the thing. There's also like older forms of imperialism in the region were also not necessarily sectarian were not chauvinist. I guess that's the better word, is that we're not chauvinist in intent, right? Like again, I'm going to be a flag-waving Iranian here and be like, yeah, like the Persian Empire was multi-ethnic, was multilingual. And there even were kind of like what today under the, you know, Cyrus cylinder. I mean, we can't make whatever. I'm not an ancient historian, but like these were attempts to create, to deal with diversity, what we today call diversity, right? And the thing is that like, because we are so, I don't know, like compressed or like over determined by the history of liberalism, we somehow think that these began with European enlightenment, that these ideas about diversity and difference and accepting all these things, that this is somehow the lessons of understanding minority in Europe, which as you point out in the book, like is a question predominated, not always, but predominantly of like, how do Jews relate to non-Jews in this non-Jewish place, supposedly, right? Like Europe is a non-Jewish place itself its own ideological bearings, right? Which is the irony of Zionism, is that it accepts the anti-Semitic worldview, the racist worldview that Jews don't belong anywhere else except for Israel. I mean, this is the insane, I mean, everybody points this out. It's not me just saying this, but like, this is something that when I think about it, it's just like, what? You guys adopted a hateful worldview of yourself, like a negative worldview of yourself, and projected that as the centerpiece of your political project? Do you really think this is going to last? Like, do you really think that, like, creating, like, assuming that Jews don't belong anywhere and they have one homeland, which is like one of the sort of views of certain kinds of Zionism, it's like, that itself is an insane idea, right? Like, crazy thing, and I think about that, is that this is not, I said this to your brother in his episode, the weird sort of finger trap that Zionism is stuck in, is that it has to fight against its own terrible view of itself, right? That, like, the Jewish state is Jewish because nobody else wants us, like, which is a terrible view of the world, you know, which you can't help but think like, oh, of course you project this onto Palestinians as racist and they hate you and they want to come and lynch us and all that stuff. Like, of course that got expressed that way. I mean, I don't know. That wasn't even the question.
So what is the question?
I don't know what the question is. I guess the question is...
I think the more difficult... I mean, yes, you're absolutely... I mean, there's no question that Zionism in terms of Palestine, you know, is unquestionably a settler colonial project, in the sense of when they come in, they want to supplant the Palestinians, or they want to ignore the Palestinians initially. It's a quote, a land without a people for a people without a land, is this kind of myth that sort of captures a certain kind of Zionist a reading of Palestine that does enormous damage, ultimately, of course, to the Palestinians, who are the native population, who are, you know, expelled in 1948. But I think the hard question, Sina, is to think also about, well, how does this relate then to the other histories that evolve in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, without, as I said, as I always have to say this, because I feel I don't want anyone to misinterpret what I'm saying, without diluting from, or without in any way obfuscating, because that's part of what my book is trying to not do, is not to obfuscate. I don't want to obfuscate. I want to talk about Palestine, but I want to put it in the context of the rest of the region, so that we don't do what we often do in American academia, which is to take Palestine and isolate it. I mean, even in our discussion today, you've often made reference to indigenous struggles and to native struggles, and all of which, of course, are at one level totally appropriate. But at another level, there's an entire other history of the Ottomans, you know, and so that settler colonial frame doesn't work in that same way, of other countries in the region who tried to resolve their problems and then ended up creating sort of some fairly catastrophic experiments, whether we're talking, and certainly violent experiments. And so the issue for me is to try to think through these things in parallel and see where they relate and how they relate to each other, and as opposed to focusing on only, I mean, obviously in today's moment, it's understandable why we're talking about, you know, Palestine, because it is the urgent crisis, and it is a crisis for the world. And it's not just for the Palestinians and not just for the Arabs and not just for Muslims, obviously. It is a problem for the world that people are suffering and need liberation and freedom and justice. But my point is always to say also in the context of the book is to say, okay, but how does this struggle relate to these other struggles that take place in other parts? And how did different people imagine the ecumenical sort of the pluralism? How did other people politicize pluralism other than the Zionists? Because we know what the Zionists have done, and we can see the catastrophic results for Palestinians, but also for Jews in the Arab East. Let's look at how Lebanese, how Iraqis, how others politicize. In other words, you know, put sovereignty and pluralism together. How do they relate this problem or this relationship? And it wasn't that easy, and it wasn't easy to navigate. And it's my point is that we need to also sort of look at that and examine that as scholars of the region. Do you see what I'm saying? Does that make any sense? I really want to make sure.
Yeah, it does.
That we end up talking about sort of other aspects of our history, because otherwise we end up only being, I mean, part of what you're saying is that the reason, of course, why there's such an emphasis on Palestine is completely understandable. At the most basic level, the human cause of liberation, it doesn't need an argument really at that level. But part of it is because the West is so directly and obviously implicated. in Zionism, in colonial Zionism, in the oppression of the Palestinians, in their dispossession. But in other parts of the Middle East, the West is still implicated, but not as overtly or as directly. And then it becomes a much more difficult question for people in the region to think about, because you don't have this kind of, it's not as, Palestine is I don't want to say easy, I don't want to be misunderstood. I mean, but it's such an obvious, flagrant right and wrong in Palestine, which is why Palestine has always been such a generative condition for Arab solidarity, because you don't need to explain to people what's right and what's wrong in Palestine. It's so obvious, right? Nobody needs to, you don't need to convince anyone that the Palestinians are oppressed. It's just obvious. It's so basic. And you don't have the level of propaganda and dehumanization of the Palestine question that you do in the West. On the other hand, there are other questions: Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Egypt, Bahrain, as you said, and these also need to be historicized. And how do we do all of them at the same time? And that really is the most difficult part.
Osama, thank you for your time. This was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. What are you working on? The book is called, get the book, everyone. It's called Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame and the Making of the Modern Arab World. What are you working on these days? What you got cooking, and where can we find you? What are you doing?
I am writing an article on Arab Zionists, believe it or not. I don't know where that's going to go and what's going to happen with that. But that's what I'm writing on.
Oh God! Like the speaker, like they're the that guy that they send out messages. That guy.
No. More complicated thing than that. But anyway, so that's, I'm still thinking through this argument. But otherwise, I'm right now I'm at Rice University and a professor of history here. And so thank you so much, Sina. I really appreciate the chat.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Take care.